have your attention, please? Sorry to interrupt your conversations. It's my great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker today, Rosalie Ham. Rosalie grew up in Dooraldri in rural New South Wales. The characterisation of country towns and the people who live in them infiltrate Rosalie's work. Her best known book, The Dressmaker, was initially published in 2000 and came about after Rosalie decided to take a writing course. Her characters of Tilly, Teddy and Molly found a new presence in the award-winning film adaptation produced and directed by Sue Maslin and Jocelyn Morehouse. The popularity of the book and later the film demonstrate a keen appetite throughout Australia and right around the world to find out more about the unique culture, landscape and people in our country towns. I've read an article where Rosalie described the experience of being on set, playing an extra in the film adaptation of her book, attending the wedding of the characters she created, William Beaumont and Gertrude Pratt, in the dusty landscape of the Wimmera, dressed up as Dungata. It's hard to imagine what that would have felt like. Rosalie's later book, Summer at Mount Hope, published in 2005, again looks at rural communities, rural people, and what life is like on a farm, which Rosalie has experience in. And then There Should Be More Dancing, published in 2011. It characterises the way, it uses a really good sense of humour, which all of Rosalie's books do, to characterise what it's like to age and family relations. So I'd really love to welcome Rosalie up here to share her insights into taking stories about rural towns to the world and to maybe even give us a preview of her fourth book, which is about, of all things, irrigation. Thank you, Rosalie.
Thank you, Emma, and thank you for having me. I'll just have to say at the outset that it's absolutely terrifying. But I'm just going to bluff my way through and maybe you won't twig. I do come from Dooraldri. I was born and raised in Dooraldri, or Dooraldri, if you live in Dooraldri, you can say it like that. And I wrote that book, The Dressmaker, as part of a course at RMIT. I didn't ever think that it would be published because they told us you don't get your first novel published, it's your second one, and then you get the first one out and pop it out very quickly after the second one that's published, and you scrub up the first one and pop it out, or things along, cynical things like that, and that didn't prove to be true at all. The Dressmaker emerged as part of the writing course. We all sent them off to publishers just for the heck of it. We thought we would get a nice rejection letter and then feel validated as a writer. And they got back to me and said, oh, we'd like to work with you with a view to publication. And I said, oh, okay, fine. And then it was published and I thought that it would sink on the shelf, but it didn't. What occurred to me between the time that I'd written it and by the time that it was published is that I was going to have to spend the rest of my life defending that book and explaining it, and explaining that no, country people aren't like that. They are not like that. Those sorts of people are all over the planet. They're in every staff room, they're in every street, they're in every suburb, they're in every sports club, they're in any sewing club, they're in any kind of club, they're in every city. And I just find myself having to explain that over and over and over again. So I got a little bit defensive, and so by the time I wrote Summer at Mount Hope, I had a main protagonist whose name was Phoebe Krupp, and she was an independent woman who was loved sheep, loved the whole industry surrounding sheep, but was stuck on a vineyard. And so my efforts to get Phoebe to emerge as a complete person in a world that was run basically by men was the focus of my next book. It was about how to make a life worthwhile, and it was a kind of an anti-romance. I flipped the idea of romance and made it an anti-romance so that loyalty and friendship and sheep in the end win out and romance doesn't. And then I repeated it again when I wrote There Should Be More Dancing, and I used stock standard characters again, because you've got to create the empathy, And then I made it interesting by making it not predictable. But I created those stock standard characters to make the point that they're not all rural characters that are weird. You get weird characters everywhere, and you get a cross-section of characters wherever you go. And I'm just going to follow Stephen's brief a bit today, because when he sent me the information, he was talking about how, the information today, he was talking about how country people or the rural Australia can get their stories heard. And I started off investigating that, and then I decided it was the Bush City Gap, and I thought, well, that's a bit cliche, I shouldn't go there, but I couldn't help it, I've ended up in there anyway. But I won't bore you to death too much about it. I'll just tell you what I think, and then you can either throw tomatoes at me or do whatever you will, but there will be question and answer. And I haven't really talked about the dressmaker terribly much, but I'm really happy to talk about that, because that of course then put all my characters from Dungatar on 40 foot of Technicolor screen all over the planet. So I'm just going to have to keep explaining it in every country in the world the rest of my life. At the moment I'm reading Scott Bevan's biography of William Dobell, and it's a thing, I don't know about you, you're all writers, but I don't read anybody else's fiction while I'm trying to write something, because I get to the third paragraph where the husband says, I love my wife dearly, and I think, oh, she's going to die, and then I put it aside. So the book about William Dobell and his portrait of Joshua Smith, which won the 1943 Archibald Prize, the central argument in that seems to be about the portrait. It seems to be basically, this is the argument, it's an accurate depiction or caricature, or is it, or not? And that begs the question, is what the artists see accurate or true? Well, it is what the artist sees, and it's the way the artist sees it, governed by how the artist was raised and what their landscape of their imagination is like, what it was like when it was formed. So a portrait or a depiction of somebody else might be true, but it might not be true. So behind that is, what is the intention of the artist or the person presenting the depiction, and what do they want to convey through it? And it's my concern that in Australian media and literature and art, that the depiction of rural Australia isn't true, but it's the way it's seen by those who depict it. And I just think that there is a way of depicting things in that, but they need to be authentic. And I find a lot of images and a lot of stories that come out of rural Australia are not really authentic. And I think that I've got a right to talk about that, because I'm one of the people that did that. So to the question of how can the bush make itself heard, I think the answer is to make the representations of rural Australia more on a par with the city. And to do that, we need to have more accurate representation of what the bush actually does in the city. I know that the Weekly Times and the Stock and Land and all those rural magazines do that. I understand that. I read them and I see them. But it doesn't get to the city unless you watch Landline on Sunday at lunchtime. And I don't know why they don't put Landline on Tuesday or Wednesday at 7:30. I just think it's just so interesting and wonderful. And it tells you so much. Anyway, I should write to the Green Guide about it, I suppose. So to have a more accurate representation of what the bush actually does and is in the city media, and of course the rural, some rural media, some rural art, some rural literature, that it's not a representation that results in a ruralist. I'd like to have a reflection of rural Australia that is not a representation that is immediately dismissed by city people, and they just say that, oh well, that's other, that's alien. A bit like the myth that's sort of travelled through the 200 plus years that we've been here, that somehow the bush is terrifying and alien and different and dangerous, and it's a place where you send convents and they all dwelled on the edge of the country and didn't penetrate into the heart of the country and just saw it as one big dangerous place. But because there are all sorts of people who live in rural Australia and all sorts of industries and ethnicities, and that needs to be reflected a lot better. People in rural areas aren't actually any different to people in the city in lots of ways. They share a love of sport, art, technology, science, travel, film, music and innovation. You know that. We watch the same TV shows and we spend our weekends in similar ways. And it's the similarities that I think need to be emphasised. And the connection between the rural and the urban, and the fact that one can't survive without the other, and that the bush isn't alien, and that it's not McLeod's daughters or the farmer wants a wife or Crocodile Dundee or Waking Fright. Well, not all of it. Some of it is. I have to admit that, but not all of it. And also portraying a sense of place, I think, a bit more accurately is important, because to the city people that I encounter, and they're not representative of all city people either, I understand that, but they think anything past Craigieburn is the outback. And they just don't think it, and they look at me and they say, "You're from the country." And I say, "Yes, I'm from Jewellery." And my city friends, their eyes glaze over. But I was just talking with Emma previously, if you give them a rural product, some oil or some olives or some bread, and you put it in a package that says this is from Wangaratta, they go, "Oh my God, isn't that fantastic?" But they don't make the connection that everything in the supermarket actually comes from a farm. Like, there's just this huge gap there. And I just think that needs to be somehow altered. I don't know how we're going to do it. I don't have the solutions. I'm just talking about what I think. It'll start with me by writing novels that portray the rural Australia in a much more authentic way. A group of kids, I just want to make a brief note that there's irrigation plains and there's tablelands and there's dairy country and there's potato grown country and there's vineyards and there's cotton and all those different cultural identities and productivity areas don't kind of reach people in the city. I just think it's all the same out there. There's a group of kids that I teach, and they're mostly from overseas, and they went on a trip to Central Australia. And when they came back from Central Australia, I said, "How was it? What was it like?" And they said, "There's no reception out there." And then I said, "Yes, but what did you think of Central Australia?" And they just said, "Well, we're not going back because there's no reception out there. You can't get the phone." And so I just thought it was a terrible thing that they'd come back from Central Australia without knowing anything about what was in between the airport and landing at Alice Springs, all those different layers of farming and productivity and rural cultures that are out there, and that the most important thing that they brought back was that it was a place that they shouldn't go and they couldn't go. And so I think we need to kind of see if we can address that in some way as well. There's the root of the bush city divide that Les Murray calls the rift that runs through the whole of Western culture, and that's a fundamental tension which convenience sake we'll call the war between the Boeotians and the Athenians. The Boeotians being the rural people and the Athenians being cultured and sophisticated city people. And Peter Porter and Les Murray had quite an argument about that. But I won't go into that today. But basically what Hesiod did in the 8th century BC was wrote a poem that was called Work and Days that talked about the superior lifestyle of rural people. And the Athenians dismissed it outright and just said it was rubbish, that we're all boorish. And I think that kind of still is the attitude of a lot of city media these days, that we're boorish and we're stupid and we're primitive and we're dull-witted and quaint out there as well. And I think that like the ancient Greeks and like everybody before them, we have to get back to worshipping the grain god or goddess, the sun gods, the tree gods, all the gods out there, and we have to make people a little bit more spiritually aware of nature and what it's like to be out there standing in a paddock, as I recently did. I drove from Horsham across to Cobram in a car on my own. It was fantastic. And I stopped and I got out and I took photographs of all that wonderful new technology that is irrigation technology. And I did a bit of paddock standing. And it's just, and I felt all of the other rubbish that you carry around in your head, it all started to vanish. I don't know why. I think it's got to do with the vastness and the space, but all the other stuff just vanished and I started getting ideas. It's a wonderful thing. We need to tell people that if you go to the country, you get good ideas. Because I did. I started stopping my car and writing things down on bits of paper because I haven't worked out the technology. I'm sure there's something in that car that I can speak to that'll do it for me, but I haven't quite worked it out yet. So it's a wonderful place, the country, and we need to make people see what it's really like and not what just the impressions that people get from grabs on the 7 o'clock news. As I say, move Landline to 7:30 on the ABC and put it on Channel 10 on Saturday morning, or 9, I don't mind. There's also an attitude of, if you make it big in the country, then you can go to the city and there seems to be affirmation of you as a real artist if you make it in the city. And it's kind of, there's something slightly false and I can't think of the word, derogatory, when someone says, oh, she's big in Shepparton. You know, and that's just not the way it should be, because if you're big in Shepparton, as far as I'm concerned, that you're connecting with the local people on a level, and those people, the Boeotians, are superior because they're more in touch with what is real. And I just think that we need to address that, and we need to tell people that the people in Shepparton aren't any different, or most of them, than the people in Toorak. Everybody still likes the same. Everybody appreciates art. Everybody reads. There's people like that all over the place. They're not just in the cities. And there's a theory that a lot of our artists have actually gone overseas to make it big. And a lot of the early artists from a century or more ago, the Streetons and the Boyds and all those people, they went there, but they didn't have anything to say to the people over there when they got there. The landscape was different. They were removed from the inspiration to what they did. And so they all came home again. And when they came home, they were lauded because they'd made it big over there in the centre, not rural, old, dark and scary Australia, out there where the convicts went, where you can get eaten by giant funnel web spiders. A barrister once said to me, farming's not a viable business. His friend, the financial whiz, had said that to him, and I thought it was a very odd comment, because it denies what farming is, and it denies there is a rural community, and that rural community serves a purpose, and he suggests that it's a waste of time, money, and effort. And my response was, but they're primary producers. They produce food and fibre, and they make things that you live in. You know, they clothe you from the elements, and they build your house. And he said, yeah, still not a viable business, though. And I've wondered at that attitude as well. It's not all about money, it's not all about business. And the fact that he didn't understand that if you don't have a rural community that's producing primary products, you die. He was only interested in the business side of things, and I've never ever actually forgotten that. The fact that I'm related to him is doubly insulting, but I won't go into that. And so I think since it all began on the land and the earth, and that's the earth that's sustaining everything, then we, like the ancient Greeks, do need to get back to understanding what it's really about. And as I said, I'm guilty of sort of conveying a kind of a stereotype in the dressmaker. And tragically, that occurred mostly through the setting. And because it was set in a small community, people made, in the Dusty Plains, people made assumptions about it. So in my current novel, I'm still on the plight of rectifying everything, and I've got a character called Isabel, and she's based on a real person. And she's based on a woman who I know quite well, who occasionally gets up at 4:30 in the morning, and she drives down to Melbourne, and she stops on the way, and she unloads her fine merino fleeces that she breeds. And all the pashminas and scarves and hats and gloves that the local craft society make. And she unloads them at boutiques all the way down here until she gets to Collins Street and she unloads them here. And then she drives on out to Geelong Grammar, and she probably does a stint on the tuck shop and sees the children and meets with the head of form, whatever it is. And then she travels and visits her elderly, ageing aunt in Toorak. And then she drives back home to a property not far from Jerildre. And she's done that all in a day. And she probably checks on her merinos before she goes to bed. And then she probably sits down later on and does a bit of online wheat trading. And if she has to, she'll open the fridge and she'll cook dinner for 15 with a lettuce and a tomato, then pretty up and look gorgeous and dance beautifully all night as well. And so I've got that character in my novel, which is supposed to be about irrigation. And I just know that people are going to say to me, but people like that don't exist. And I'm going to have to say, oh, yes, they do. You just don't know about it because you don't go anywhere past Craigieburn. And you really should. On the other hand, I think what I am really good at is making people identify with my characters, because I do know them and I do understand them, but I've just got to learn to do it a little bit more smartly. I don't think I can ever change the Bush City gap, but I'm going to sure as hell try not to perpetuate the cliché of what the rural Australia is like. I did a little bit of research. The Australian collection of Australia's 100 greatest books, 1985, only a third were set in the bush, and most of them were books that were written more than 70 years ago. In Goodreads, top 100s, 30 books are set in the bush, and the mostly older, again, Australian classics like Voss or A Fortunate Life or Thornbirds, which aren't really all that authentic. And then I had a bit of a look at rural romance, just for the heck of it. And all I did was look at the covers, because they were interesting in themselves. There were many, many check shirts. There were many, many check shirts open to the waist, showing six packs. There were many, many horses on covers. There were many, many girls in floral frocks against the red sunset, sometimes with horses. There were ragged mountain ranges that were red under the setting sun, and there were hundreds and hundreds of cowboy hats. And I just wondered why any publishing house would do that. And of course the answer is because they're selling to a certain type of reader. But again, they're perpetuating a myth that isn't really accurate or authentic, and it's a misrepresentation, and it's not true. I once tried to get There Should Be More Dance in my third novel, which is set in urban Brunswick with a range of quirky characters, published overseas, and the publisher looked at me and said, no, but they won't buy it overseas because it doesn't have a red sunset or a vast outback vista in it. And I said, but it's got interesting people. And she said, yes, but you get ethnic people everywhere. You know, they know about stuff like that in New York. What they really want is the outback. And so, I mean, what's a girl supposed to do? How are you meant to get beyond those sorts of fixed ideas? There doesn't seem to be any great stories in the grubby, dun-coloured plains of the Riverina, which is where mine is set, the agrarian belt that is flat and scrubby with sheep and irrigation. I think Roger MacDonald was the last person to do that, in his book that was titled The Ballad of Desmond Cale. And I just kind of think that title also perpetuates a kind of feeling, a kind of stereotype and a cliche as well, the ballad. We're thinking Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson. Bush ideals have been revered in recent years with the screen stories like Bush Tucker Man and well-known Australian films built on stories or concerning the bush, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Eliza Fraser, Breaker Morant, Gallipoli, The Man from the Snowy River, Crocodile Dundee, Rabbit Proof Fence, Ten Canoes. And they all tell a very good story, and they're all excellent, but they're not necessarily authentic. I think there's a way of portraying authentic by still maintaining a good story and something where there is empathy, something that you can recognise, and something where there is drama. And we do need people like Liam Hemsworth and, in his day, Jack Thompson, I guess, in there as a bit of a an attractive thing for the girls to look at. And we do need a few good sorts for the blokes to look at too. But you can get beyond that and you can still make a story authentic and a little bit more representative of what it really is. Plus telling everybody that the rural Australia is a primary producer and there are wonderful things happening there. And there is science and there is technology and there is space. And you can imagine things. For my master's, I studied three stories. One was Loaded by Christos Tsoukas. The other one was Silence is Long Gone by Anson Cameron. And the third was The Idea of Perfection by Kate Grenville. In Silence is Long Gone, Anson Cameron, he's a Shepparton boy whose novel is set in Sydney and a fictional place called Hannah, which is in central Australia. It's a place where the city bush outback collide and depend on each other to work and prosper. In Hannah, the landscape renders everyone equal. The city folk, the miners, the executives, the travellers and the locals. Technology makes the place livable. But because the novel is written by someone from the country who lives in the city and doesn't see the difference, there's not much difference between city and bush. In the novel, city and bush are melded, and it's the various character portrayals where the difference lives. It's not the landscape on which they dwell or where they were made or moulded. It's the difference between the individual. It's their own idiosyncrasies that speak, and you don't need to stand them under a gum tree or put them on a horse to make the story interesting. It's the characters themselves. And that's something I'm going to see if I can strive for. The Idea of Perfection, set in Karakarook, Kate Grenville actually admits that she wrote truthfully about how a country town feels to a townie like me. But we all know that how a country town feels to a town person isn't actually how it is. But then you would probably have to write how it feels from the perspective of country town to make it sell, so people could think it was quaint and wacky and zany. So it's a hard argument. In the tradition of the characters of Dave from Steel Rudd's on our selection, there's a bloke named Chook in Karakarook. He's got coarse hands and bushy eyebrows and wears a battered felt hat. He spits, he hates greenies and employs the vernacular effectively. The waitress at the Caledonian Hotel calls Douglas love, and the barman, like most of the blokes, is taciturn and greets everyone with g'day mate. Grenville's country characters are seemingly the product of her vision of a bush landscape, and it's accurate to a degree. There are people like that. But they're also in the pub down the road. They're also in urban areas. And why people have to keep attributing them exclusively to the country is it gets up my nose. That's all there is to it. It just gets up my nose. I also did a little bit of research, and I won't waffle on for too much longer. And I found an article, and admittedly it was written in the year 2000, but I still think it holds some sort of relevance. And here's what it says. Capturing the Heart of the Region, How Regional Media Define Community, and it's by Jackie Hewitt, and you can find it online. Regional media plays a central role in constructing and cementing the identity and culture of communities and their publics. It generally accepts that media are the key institution in the process of identity formation and that the images they portray are powerful and are abiding. Although the significance of the metropolitan media's role in identity formation should not be underestimated, it is the regional level that most powerful and abiding images of Australia's regional identity are formed and entrenched in the public psyche via the media. A community comes to recognise and hence know itself through its representation in local media. Part of this recognition process involves the establishment of a set of norms for behaviour, appearance and characteristics which are applied to both those within and outside the community, and these norms are played out through the texts of regional newspapers, and those who abide by them are included in the conceptualisation of the public constructed by the media in applying these norms, while those who do not are excluded. And it goes on to say that's partly because the media generally reflect a unique place, space and role of the regional media, but it then goes on to say that they perpetuate the myth, the same myth. It's the media in the rural communities that unconsciously or consciously feed off their community and then play back to their community what their community is like, and so a community acts according. It was a fascinating read. Does it make you feel powerful? And so I'm very conscious about this when I'm going to write my next, or finish my next novel, which is about irrigation water. And again, I have to do some misrepresenting in that novel, because I'm trying to write about irrigation water. And I can't write what I really want to write, because I'll get a tome this big and it'll be enormously boring and people won't read it. And so therefore I have to kind of house it in love and betrayal and death and mystery and the gothic nature of the landscape, the life and death situation of it, because that's what's going to sell and that's what I have to do to get my message to mostly city people about what the farmers are on about when they're talking about allocations and the lack of allocations and how that can affect a small community. And so I know that I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life defending that to every farmer and irrigator that I meet, because all of their situations are different. And I think that probably you in the rural media cop flack for your depictions all the time as well. And so I think that it's a strange and wonderful industry to be in. And I found myself faced with it in Horsham the other day, and there was a picture that was taken of me and some school kids, and the journalist, who is a lovely girl, but I didn't have the energy at that time to change it, but she made me squat down on my haunches and had all the school children peeping over my shoulder to see me holding my own book. And it went under the headline of something like local author, or no, dressmaker author visits Horsham and something like that. And I just thought, why could that journalist and the photographer have made the focus the school children and the content of the book and how that book had affected their learning, and what was it in that book and in their literature class that was important, rather than just doing that surface picture of me looking like a dickhead on my haunches. You know, and so, but I should have argued at the time and said, can't we do something else? But it's not my job. I don't know my audience. And so I just went along with it. So it's those sorts of things that I think that we could change. And it might take us another 270 odd years, but we might be able to get it done. The other thing I'd like to suggest also to the rural writers out there, puns. The puns. And I know that this is the point, but we read them out in our house. We read out the puns from the Weekly Times and the Stock and Land and the Age and the Sun Herald and whatever it is we happen to be reading. And I understand that that's the point, but oh, some of them are terrible. And I have this joke with my brother when we're walking around Lara Plains at Girildary, and he's kicking the dust with his boots, or looking at the weeds growing up through the stubble. And he says something about the fact that it's being dry, and we both just say, well, you should get down on your haunches and get some red dust and let it drip through your fingers or drain through your fingers, and I'll put you on the front page of a newspaper. And he goes, yes, and we fall about laughing. We don't anymore, because it's got a bit sad. So there's things like that. But in terms of getting out, getting regional and rural stories heard, I just think that they need to be more authentic, and I think that the city needs to be able to look at the rural areas of Australia and see them as what they are. They're places of great science, great innovation. There's lots of migrants out there. There's a huge amount of industry. And I just think putting Landline on at 7 o'clock. And the bush doesn't form our national character anymore. We've moved, just as we are not a nation of swimmers, if you go to the beach, nobody's swimming. If you go to the swimming pools, nobody's swimming. We're not a nation of swimmers. We're not a nation full of blokes in cowboy hats looking like Lee Kernaghan, and we're not all about mateship predominantly. There is much more to it than that. And this misogynists and men haters and people with blue hair and pierced ears and pierced everything else all over the planet. They're not just in the city. They're everywhere. Everybody is everywhere. And I'd just like to say, in defence of my character Isabel, in the face of the Billy Brownless phenomenon, which I have to live with whenever somebody says, oh, you're from Jerilderie. Oh, that's Billy Brownless. And I go, yeah, but we're not all like that. Football's just a subculture of a small culture, and there are other types of people in Jerilderie other than Billy Brownless, who is adorable, I know, in a doofus, sort of flawed kind of way. But we're not all like that, so we don't all have to be like that. And I wish the city people would understand that, the city people that put television shows on like that. Anyway, so that's all really I've got to say. I hope there was something in there that was of value. And thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. That's really got me thinking. I've got lots of questions, and perhaps you do as well, and we'll have a few minutes now to ask some questions of Rosalie. And I work for the department that creates Landline, and we had the opportunity to broadcast Landline in prime time at 7:30, but over summer when 7:30 was having a little break.
Oh.
And the reception was really good. We had great ratings, so you never know. Maybe down
the
track.
Yeah.
Rosalie, I'm interested in you talking about you clawing back, you know, some of your characters in The Dressmaker and characterisations played on the stereotypes of country towns, something that, you know, you're looking to do differently in your next book. But don't you think some of those stereotypes are true? You know, the busybody and the the women on farms with money and the outsider who's allowed in, you know, just a little bit. Like, don't you think some of that's accurate?
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right, that is. But when I left home this morning in my street in Brunswick, the woman across the road knows exactly what time I left home. She knows. She watches everything. There's a parking Nazi in our street, and there's a house down the street that is it's old and dilapidated, and some woman lives in there where nobody sees her very much. She's just this cobwebby thing that comes out. She's a bit like Molly Dunnage. But so my point is, yes, do use them and use them for empathy, but I've got to change the setting so that they're not all just in rural Australia. They're everywhere, and it just seems to be this divide where people in the country are portrayed as that and people in the city don't actually see those people in front of them, and they're there too. Yeah, but they do create a great deal of empathy, and people do know them and understand them.
Mm-hmm. We have a microphone, so let indicate if you've got a question. And yeah, Emma.
Hi, Emma
from
Eastern Farms. Can I just say a lot of the puns today have come from suburbs. Who also grew up spelling mistakes too, so that's important, and grammar mistakes. I just wanted to ask you, you talked a lot about the fact that there's stereotypes that you try to, sometimes you've written about them, sometimes you haven't. It sounds to me like you really want to get some diversity in the way that you write about regional Australia.
Yes.
How possibly can you do that, and what kind of voices?
I don't know. I just don't know what to say about it because I was blocked. I'm blocked on every front. If I say I want to do that, then they say, well, they're not recognisable and they won't believe that, like my character of Isabel. So I just think that it's up to the people in rural Australia to do that themselves. And they do an awful lot for themselves. They're very self-sufficient and they're innovative and they generate interest in their community and they fundraise and they do everything brilliantly, but they just don't seem to be able to get stories that show off the other part, the solar power farms at Mildura and huge industries to do with solar, and there's a place where they're converting seawater into ordinary water, and the byproduct of that is fertilizer, and it's a huge project, and I remember reading about it in the Weekly Times, but I don't know where it is if I'm in the city. Nobody's told me about it. So it seems to be that there has to be some sort of cross culture. There seems to be some sort of line where those stories that would come from you don't get into city newspapers, and city and media and the people who write books and paint pictures don't get beyond that line to get to the country to see what really is happening there. And I don't know how you're going to do that because of that huge gap that's there, that's always been there since we came here to this country, and that whole Banjo Patterson, Henry Lawson, Bush City divide and all that sort of stuff. It just seems to be there. And you would think that with technology, there would be more of a crossover, and there is more of a crossover, except for the cultural, artistic things. They haven't crossed over. So there's more communication happening, but the really interesting, wonderful stories that need to get to the city from the bush aren't part of that. And I don't know what to do about that.
And probably for rural journalists, I guess we've all had that story that we've told that's about a strange animal or has a quirky element that's just gone off and gone viral. But then some of the stories that do portray the diversity or the strength of character or something different, it's a harder sell. Yeah. Any other questions, please? Yes.
I'm a bit fortunate because I seem to have established a kind of a readership early on with The Dressmaker, and it's not about the content so much, it's about my somewhat bent, dark and nasty sense of humour, which seems to appeal to a lot of people. So it's been my experience that they've basically let me rip, but they have questioned me and I have had to convince them about some things because they are a city industry. They don't travel much to rural or regional Australia. And so there are, on some occasions, where I have to tell stories and prove my point and prove what my characters would do, and they've had to kind of acquiesce and let me go. It's a really lovely thing, but there's a lot of women at a certain point in publishing, not right at the top, but there's a lot of people out there, kind of associate editors and things like that, and they're generally country girls that have moved to the city, because country girls like myself, we've all grown up driving a truck, shooting a gun, opening a gate, shearing a sheep, cutting burrs, herding sheep on a horse, fixing a fuse, changing our own tyre, pulling our weight at harvest, contributing and doing our share of the chores, and we just seem to be quite capable. So when Sue Maslin and I decided to turn The Dressmaker into a film, we weren't daunted as much as we think as some of the producers around her would have been. She was the one brave person that stood up and said, I can make this film and I won't change the ending to a wedding. And she did.
We've probably got time just for one or two more questions.
Hi there, Jim Ball from Rehab New Persons Group. I play footy in July, spent some time with Caledonia, and I think we're famous for more than just your books. The new Kelly jewellery letter is obviously a great way of crossing that bridge.
Absolutely, yeah.
My views and novels are doing in jewellery rather than everywhere else. My question is about culture in rural Australia, and I think there's an innate modesty for rural people to tell stories that connect with city people. They're shy, they don't want to talk about their success.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a role for city people to tell the country people's story because they have the confidence, the connection, and maybe the understanding to tell those stories more effectively in rural Australia?
And I think that they should get invited. I'm going to this thing called the Hatfield Happening. I'm not even quite sure where it is. I just know that I have to get to Balranald and then keep driving for another 14 days or something. But I'm going there next weekend, and they're getting me to go there and talk. And apparently there's hundreds and hundreds of women there, and they provide hairdressing and massages and childcare and shopping and all sorts of other things, and there's a key address. That is a remarkable and wonderful and glorious thing. And there'll be lots and lots of blokes will go to that as well, because there'll be something for everybody. But I don't know, does anybody in this room, have you ever heard about it? Amazing. It's see, there is one, example, if you got someone from one of the big newspapers in some sort of urban place to come down, and if you would get them a mentor that was from the local area or someone that would explain everything to them and sell them the beauty of what was happening out there and why it's a wonderful thing, rather than, wow, look at all these women, and I bet the CWA's there too, and all that sort of stuff. If we get a good, authentic story, then it would be a wonderful thing. But that, again, there's not that connection, and I don't know why nobody's does that. Why haven't they got Virginia Trioli out there or something?
She'd love it, I'm sure.
Probably because she's sleep deprived. Yeah. One last question, Helen.
Sheila from far east Gippsland. A lot of my interest has been crossing the divides of otherness between rural people and people who make decisions, which are usually urban-based white males. That's been the centre of my work for about 20 years, and I find one of the ways to do it is, as you say, through stories and sharing forums like this where people can hear from each other are really important. And I think one of the great examples that's happened in recent years is the emergence of things like the Bendigo community bags, which came about because rural people said we don't want that urban model, it doesn't suit us, and they set up partnerships in rural areas, and now that's also happening in urban communities. And when we find the way to benefit our communities in rural areas, it benefits urban areas as well, and I think those partnerships and sharing those stories are a really exciting thing.
Yeah, good. Good comment, thank you. There's a bit of liaising I didn't know about.
Well, we might leave it there and just continue our conversations as we wander out of the room. But thank you so much, Rosalie. It's, yeah, lots of ideas there. And I think a good point to take this conversation is that the Rural Press Club of Victoria, we have our awards coming up, and we'll certainly be looking for stories that reflect the diversity of regional Victoria. And we'll be looking for, you know, those stories that cut through and reflect the issues, the people and the communities that make regional Victoria and rural Victoria so great. So entries will open at the end of next month, and then the awards night where the winners will be announced is in August, the last Friday in August, the 26th. So definitely think about your body of work and perhaps some of the stories that have reflected some of the themes that we've been talking about today. Thank you so much for coming. We have a special token of our appreciation, which includes olives from Western Victoria and oil from Western Victoria. So if you don't want it, you can give it to one of your city friends and say. And they'll be even more amazed. But thank you so much, Rosalie. It's been great to have you here. So thank you.